today. It's one of the biggest days in the US electoral calendar, Super Tuesday. And Polly Toynbee on what happens when a senior civil servant accuses a minister of being a liar and a bully. Today is Super Tuesday, the biggest moment in the US election calendar after polling day itself.
I will be the first to say that the first four contests haven't gone exactly as I'd hoped. If you want to change the outcome in the next contest, go to ElizabethWarren.com, chip in now, get
it. With primaries taking place simultaneously in 14 states, for now, Bernie Sanders remains in the lead.
We have won the New Hampshire primary. We have won the Nevada caucus. But you cannot win them all.
But fighting off Joe Biden, who has been emboldened by his landslide win at the weekend in South Carolina.
All those of you who've been knocked down, counted out, left behind, this is your campaign.
And then there's a wild card, the billionaire candidate whose name goes on the ballots today, former three-term New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg.
I am running for president to defeat Donald Trump and to unite and rebuild America.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, who will dominate on Super Tuesday?
Super Tuesday is coming.
Lauren, you're in LA, in the middle of California, ready for the big day. Tell me what the state of play is as we enter this critical moment in the race.
So Biden's victory changes the race because until then, we'd watched Bernie Sanders really take the lead and he seemed to be gathering this momentum.
Lauren Gambino is a political correspondent for Guardian US.
Now with Biden really showing signs of strength, I think you're seeing other moderate candidates really rethink their candidacy. We've already seen on Saturday, billionaire Tom Steyer, who was pulling some votes from sort of the center left, he dropped out of the race. And then Pete Buttigieg, the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, dropped out of the race.
So tonight, I am making the difficult decision to suspend my campaign for the presidency.
He effectively said he saw no path forward for himself, and he encouraged voters to start to form a consensus around a candidate that is not Bernie Sanders. And so I think he's getting out of the way to make space for a Joe Biden or possibly someone else who's still in the race.
So it sounds like there's some consolidating going on because Bernie Sanders has been doing so well in the race. I mean, Sanders still enters Super Tuesday well in the lead and with polls looking good for him. What does that mean for another candidate on the left, someone like Elizabeth Warren?
Elizabeth Warren found herself stuck between Bernie Sanders and the moderate candidates in the race. And she's tried to appeal to voters as a unity candidate, someone with, you know, respect and credentials, but who is well-liked among the party establishment and more the center-left. That's just not worked for her. And we've seen other candidates sort of fall between two stools like that. And she has just not been able to create this path that goes between Bernie Sanders and the moderates.
And we are entering the most pivotal moment of the entire race. Tell me what the candidates are bringing into Super Tuesday.
So the candidates are coming in with the delegates they've won in the first four states. Bernie Sanders has 56 delegates, Joe Biden has 48 delegates, Elizabeth Warren has 8 delegates, and Amy Klobuchar has 7 delegates. But that is just a fraction of what they're going to be competing for on Super Tuesday when more than 1,300 delegates are up for grabs, a huge proportion of the overall delegates that you need to win this nomination.
And while this does look like it's gearing up for a kind of two-way race between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, many of us are watching with interest to what looks like a kind of wild card from Mike Bloomberg entering the race today.
Yes, the first time you'll see Mike Bloomberg's name on a ballot is this Tuesday. He took this really unorthodox approach. He entered the race really late, and so he effectively had to skip the early states of Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. So we're only starting to see him now. What that means is he's been spending hundreds of millions of dollars in these Super Tuesday states. He's been on the air, he's been on the radio. You know, if you turn on your computer, if you're online, if you turn on your TV, your radio, he is there.
After years of will he or won't he, three-term New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, a former Republican...
And so we're about to see the impact of that. You know, it's sort of like, what can money buy?
Now a presidential candidate.
Mike Bloomberg will miss the first four elections, but he's gearing up for Super Tuesday. In fact, opening up six campaign offices across the state.
The battle of the billionaires is on. Michael Bloomberg officially jumping into the 2020 race and wasting no time.
He's putting the casino all on Super Tuesday, where he's banking. He can catch up.
96% of delegates are up for grabs, and so that's where we've been spending.
Okay, so Mike Bloomberg is on the ballot today for the first time. I know he's a billionaire former mayor, but what was his background before that?
His father was a bookkeeper who he likes to say never earned more than $6,000 a year. His dad died really young, and his mom then worked as a secretary. Bloomberg went on to attend Johns Hopkins. And there's kind of a telling story. He had to work at a parking lot to pay his way through college. Now, you know, there's buildings at the college with his name on it. So I think he really likes to play into that idea of self-made man living the American dream. And that is sort of, in a nutshell, what he's running on.
My father made $6,000 the best year of his life. I don't come from money. Nobody gave me a head start. I had my parents.
Bloomberg graduates. He attends Harvard Business School. And that's really where his career in business gets started. He takes a job. He works for a Wall Street investment firm. Then he's laid off. And that's a moment that he said would define the rest of his life.
But so I did have a big company. And then I started out a small company. First day it was me. Second day there were four of us. Today, there's 15,500 employees.
He's laid off, he creates the Bloomberg Terminal. It's a financial tool used by investors, and that made him this multi-billionaire that we know him as today.
Welcome to the Bloomberg.
His company is valued at $60 billion, more by some estimates. And this is sort of the cornerstone of his success.
At the touch of a key.
Why did he get into politics?
I think he saw an opportunity. He's now a New Yorker. There was a chance to run for mayor. And he's a technocrat at heart. And I think he really believes that he is, can do the most good in this executive role. And so he runs. It was 2001. He decides he's going to run for mayor of New York City. And then...
I, Michael R. Bloomberg, do solemnly swear...
He's elected.
The Constitution of the United States.
He takes office in 2002, right after the September 11th attacks. And that is a big part of his job in those early years, is rebuilding the city that has been completely shaken by this attack. The funny thing is, he was a Democrat, and before running for mayor, he switched his parties to run as a Republican, which sounds crazy to us in a city that we know is so liberal like New York City, but this was a different time. It made sense.
Yeah, so at this time, Mike Bloomberg's a Republican and Donald Trump is a Democrat. I mean, did they actually know each other?
They did. And this is what's going to be so interesting if Bloomberg is able to pull this off. It's that there's going to be these two New York billionaires who don't really have a strong sense of party.
What happened next for Bloomberg?
So Bloomberg runs for a second term, he's reelected, and then he switches his party to be an independent. So now he's...
Of course he does.
He's sort of following the changes in the city, the political winds in his city. And then he does something extremely interesting.
This is going to be one of the watershed days in financial markets history.
The financial crash happens, and he lobbies the New York City Council to change the rules so that he can run for an unprecedented third term.
He is trying to get city voters who twice before rejected the idea of changing term limits to suddenly change it just because of the economic crisis.
He's elected mayor for a third term. And then we start to hear rumblings of a possible presidential run. Pretty much every presidential election cycle since then, it's been a perennial question and a perennial almost joke.
In all that time that he was mayor of a hugely high-profile city like New York, what was he doing? And how did he keep getting reelected?
He was known for economic growth, falling crime rates, and a focus on public health. There is a view that he was a very successful mayor of New York, but there were certainly a lot of controversies. While he decided to run for president, his Democratic rivals are very eager to use all of this against him. We've seen it come up in the debates.
I'd like to talk about who we're running against. A billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg.
You mentioned controversy, and it is pretty clear that however successful Bloomberg was in terms of re-election, his record has provided plenty of attack lines for his opponents. Some of that is about who he is, a Wall Street billionaire.
Mike Bloomberg owns more wealth than the bottom 125 million Americans. That's wrong. That's immoral. That should not be the case.
And some of it is about what he's done.
The policy was abhorrent, and it was, in fact, a violation of every right people have.
Perhaps most controversial is his policy of stop and frisk, which we know here as stop and search. Why did he support that?
He says he supported it because it brought down crime. There's a video of him speaking about it where he says he put police officers in black and brown communities because that's where the crime was.
Why? Because we put all the cops in the minority neighborhoods. Yes, that's true. Why we do it? Because that's where all the crime is.
This is obviously extraordinarily controversial. A judge, in fact, ruled that this policing practice was carried out in a manner that violated the U.S. Constitution. And so since leaving office, there's been a much more serious look at this policy and what it did to black and brown communities. I mean, really young black men and brown men in New York.
Has he admitted that that was the wrong thing to do?
Yes. Bloomberg has apologized for this. But I think there's people that feel an apology is not enough, especially as you have all of these videos and past recordings of him actually defending the policy and the language that he uses. It shows that he really believed this was the most effective way of bringing down crime. I think there's a lot of critics who think an apology is not enough.
I didn't understand that back then, the full impact that stocks were having on the black and Latino communities.
And of course, people are going to be suspicious of the reason that he's apologizing now and also question what his instincts are when it comes to people of color.
It targeted communities of color. And brown men from the beginning.
And another criticism that's come up is the use of non-disclosure agreements, NDAs. What was Bloomberg using them for?
So Bloomberg had women sign non-disclosure agreements when they settled a complaint. So we know a little bit about these NDAs. Not a lot, obviously, because they're non-disclosure agreements. So we don't know the details, but we do know that women have accused Bloomberg of gender-based harassment. There's some really high-profile comments that he is alleged to have made, including one woman who was pregnant and said that Bloomberg told her to, quote, kill it, referring to her baby.
What?
Said to me, kill it.
He has completely denied that, and it was a flashpoint in a debate, and he has again denied it, but it was overheard by another colleague at the time, and this is sort of one of the most high-profile incidents of comments that Bloomberg is accused of making. Elizabeth Warren has gone at him, I think, the hardest of any candidate on the debate stage, demanded that he release these women from their non-disclosures agreements so that we can hear their side of the story.
And I hope you heard what his defense was. I've been nice to some women.
He has consented to releasing three women from their NDAs, but it is unclear how many NDAs there are and sort of what the full scope of that looks like.
That is quite a back catalogue to have and then to decide to run for president.
Well, exactly. But we're in a new era. We have a president who ran with a lot of baggage, and that didn't seem to stop him.
Okay, so he is getting a lot of flack, but what's his pitch?
He's pitching himself as the man who's uniquely positioned to beat Donald Trump. And it's no coincidence that, you know, that he's also a New Yorker, that he's also a billionaire. He thinks it's going to take this businessman, this New Yorker, to really take on Donald Trump and to beat him at his own game. Bloomberg has this quote.
I'm a New Yorker, and I know a con when I see one.
That is sort of his pitch against Donald Trump. I know this guy. I can beat him. He'd already said he wasn't going to run. But then Joe Biden started to look a little shaky as a front runner.
I'll come in the race. Michael's a solid guy. And let's see where it goes. I have no problem with him getting in the race.
He's thinking, Joe Biden doesn't look like a very strong front runner. And maybe we need someone else with unlimited ability to spend money who can take on Donald Trump. And that's why he jumps in. Democrats, repeatedly, every poll you take, they want to beat Donald Trump, and they almost don't care who it is. If you can beat Donald Trump, they will take you, despite your baggage, despite, you know, anything that they might have thought about in another election cycle, and that means a lot.
And apart from arguing that he's the man who can take on Trump, what else is he running on?
He's running on policies that he's really well known for in the U.S. So he's running on stronger gun control.
I trust Bloomberg to break the cycle of a failure and a failure, especially with gun violence bills, because he...
One of the philanthropies most associated with him is an effort to strengthen gun control measures in the U.S. to reduce gun violence. He's known sort of as this national ambassador on climate change. He's done a lot and donated many, many millions to the cause of combating climate change. He's also associated with public health. A lot of his policies revolve around health, and it should be noted he recently just cut an ad criticizing the Trump administration for its response to the coronavirus.
The coronavirus is spreading and the economy is taking a hit.
He's also been using his money to help the Democratic Party. He's become an incredibly important political donor. Does that play into his strategy?
Absolutely. He's donated to a lot of causes that make him fairly popular among Democrats, and you're seeing that. He's gotten a lot of endorsements from mayors and people you might not expect. He's gotten several endorsements from prominent Black mayors, especially when you consider the controversies he's had during his mayorship. You know, to have these prominent surrogates go out and vouch for him, there's a lot of lawmakers who do worry about a candidate who's able to sort of buy their way into this election. But at the same time, they do believe he's used his money notably, and he's investing in the causes of our time.
Look, it is Super Tuesday today. Tell us how it works.
You've got more than a dozen states all holding primaries. Everyone tries to win delegates, and the person with the most delegates comes out on top. 40% of all the delegates available are going to be allocated on Super Tuesday, so it's a massive day. That's what makes it super. And pretty much everything that comes before won't matter after today.
Where is it important to win?
Every state gets a certain amount of delegates, and the bigger the state, the more delegates you have. On Super Tuesday, you've got Texas, and then you've got California, where you have the most delegates. It's possible to do well on Super Tuesday, even if you don't come in first, because of the way delegates are apportioned. So you could come in second and still come away with hundreds of delegates in a state like California. And that's because you have to reach a 15% threshold to earn any delegates at all. And that's only likely to happen for a couple of candidates.
Now, to some extent, it feels as if Bloomberg is coming into this race because he thinks he can take on Trump with his, as you say, I know him pitch. But he's also setting himself up as the man who can take on Bernie Sanders on the left. Does Biden's resurgence change that?
This is your campaign.
Mike Bloomberg is such a question mark. We really just don't know how
he's going to impact this race because we haven't seen anyone have the chance to vote for him. We don't know who's going to vote for him. We don't know what that will look like. Does he have a constituency? We just really don't know. Now that Joe Biden's had this victory, that could change things. I mean, Joe Biden is still Joe Biden. He still comes with all of the gaffes and sort of, you know, mistakes that he's made already in this campaign. That hasn't changed, but this victory does give him that momentum that's always so critical in the race. And that could blunt, you know, maybe some of the attention that Bloomberg was hoping to get on Super Tuesday.
It feels as if, to some extent, there's a kind of battle for the soul of the Democratic Party. And it's really clear that different states take very, very different views on this. I mean, this is a race where Bernie Sanders can blow the opposition away in Nevada, and then Joe Biden can get a landslide win in South Carolina. In terms of the 14 states that are in play on Super Tuesday, what are the different forces at play?
The two biggest states have very large Latino populations, California and Texas. And we've seen Latino voters really gravitate towards Bernie Sanders. So if he's able to keep that momentum with this constituency, then we expect him to do very, very well in the Western states and states with Latino populations. Colorado's also voting. Joe Biden likely will do well in some of these Southern states where they have large African-American constituencies. That's what propelled his victory in South Carolina. He won overwhelmingly with Black voters. And so we would expect him to do well in states like Virginia, Alabama, Arkansas. I think what's interesting is, again, how Mike Bloomberg factors into all of this. There's been a lot of criticism of his record with both of these constituencies. So you would think that he wouldn't do well with Black or Brown voters. But, you know, he also appeals to, you know, more business-friendly Democrats who are, you know, frankly, very worried about a Bernie Sanders nomination.
Could this be down to two individual candidates by Wednesday?
It's possible. I think, you know, if Mike Bloomberg doesn't do well, especially after you spent, you know, upwards of $500 million of your own money on this race, I think it would be hard to justify staying in. And he's already said, I'll leave my entire organizational structure to the next nominee. He's kind of tried to say that there's some goodwill in this, that he still wants to help beat Donald Trump.
You've pointed out how important today is and how different this race will look tomorrow. What happens after this?
After Super Tuesday is Super Tuesday part two. There's going to be another big voting day about a week and a half later. And that will be another big block of states. It's not, you know, as big as the first Super Tuesday, but it's another day that will, again, clarify the race even further.
And you've mentioned a few times that what seems to unite Democrats is the idea of wanting to beat Donald Trump. A couple of quick final thoughts on that. Is he getting a bit of a free run while the party fights it out? And do the polls suggest that he's beatable?
He is absolutely getting a free run. He is really enjoying the messy race that the Democrats have. He weighs in on Twitter all the time. He likes to pick fights with each of the candidates individually. He's enjoying this. That is certainly true.
And now they have a new member of the crew, Mini Mike. Mini Mike.
Polls suggest he is beatable, but it is very close. And he is an incumbent president. And incumbent presidents typically win re-election, and with the race this close and the numbers so variable, it really anything could happen.
Lauren, thank you very much.
Thank you.
They won't tell you the truth.
That was Lauren Gambino. You can follow every twist and turn of Super Tuesday on the Guardian website. Coming up, an extraordinary spat between Home Secretary Priti Patel and the man who was the most senior official in her department. Now, on Saturday, Sir Philip Rutnam, who as permanent secretary was the most senior official in the Home Office, resigned and then did something we rarely ever see. He went straight to the television cameras and delivered an angry and emotional statement. In it, Rutnam accused Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, of waging a vicious and orchestrated campaign against him. In response to her denials, he added, "I regret, I do not believe her." Polly Toynbee has seen a lot of astonishing things in her time writing about Whitehall, but this tops the list.
Sir Philip Rutnam's action in resigning so spectacularly, in deciding to sue for unfair dismissal, is unprecedented, unknown. I don't think that's ever happened before with somebody at the very top of a senior department.
I have this morning resigned as permanent secretary of the Home Office. I take this decision with great regret after a career of 33 years.
There was a Mandarin standing in front of the BBC cameras reading out a statement that absolutely damned his employer, Priti Patel.
I have received allegations that her conduct has included shouting and swearing, belittling people, making unreasonable and repeated demands, behaviour that created fear and needed some bravery to call out.
He went so far as to call her a liar, and that's remarkable language. Normally, senior civil servants, when they run into trouble, resign quietly and go off with a reasonable payoff, their knighthood, to do something else. But he wouldn't do that. He refused to sign a non-disclosure agreement where he wouldn't have been able to tell what had happened. And he said that for the sake of protecting the rest of his staff, who he says have also been subject to the same kind of bullying, he felt he should speak out. Now the government has announced that the Cabinet Office will be carrying out an investigation into accusations that she is a bully. We've seen the backlash against Sir Philip Rutnam virulent in the Tory press, Sir Calamity, listing everything they can think of that he's done in the past. And certainly the Home Office is a nest of errors, mistakes, inadequate provision for all kinds of things, but particularly recently the Windrush scandal. I think it'll be a bloodbath of a case both ways. This comes at a time when Priti Patel is facing allegations that she has had some disrespect for the law, particularly when it came to whether or not to use force against Extinction Rebellion protesters. The Home Office say that they haven't received any formal complaints. This isn't the first time that Priti Patel has got into trouble. She had to resign from being in charge of international aid when she had taken a holiday in Israel, when she'd met the Prime Minister and a number of other important people, but without telling her Prime Minister or her Foreign Secretary, and seemed to be negotiating beyond her brief outside what was her department's responsibility. It's quite interesting that at this most embarrassing moment for the government, we should have the announcement of the Prime Minister's imminent marriage and yet another baby. We don't know whether it's his fifth or his sixth or his seventh. Very distracting. Wonder why.
That was Polly Toynbee. Do read her columns online. That's it for today. My thanks to Lauren Gambino and Polly Toynbee. This episode was produced by Serena Barker-Singh and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.